Mr. Barlow said. Your quick action saved a lot of lives, and we're grateful for it. He held out the money. The sheriff looked at the ground a moment, hiked up the belt of his pants, then took the bills and shoved them in his pocket. I was planning on bringing the twins to the show tomorrow, he said. They've been looking forward to it for a week, and the last thing I want to do is disappoint my girls. Perfectly understandable, Mr. Barlow said. And to show you how much I appreciate your support, there'll be free tickets for you and your family waiting at the ticket booth. The sheriff wrinkled his brow. Free tickets or not, I'm not going to be happy if I see an elephant with patched bullet holes in the ring. Of course not, Mr. Barlow said. That elephant is a workhorse from now on, nothing more. You better be telling the truth, or I'll shut you down and run you out of town for good. I can assure you, Mr. Barlow said. Taking that risk wouldn't be a good business move, and if there's one thing I pride myself on, it's being a smart businessman. I meant it when I said I'll kill that bull myself if necessary. He extended his hand. The sheriff shook Mr. Barlow's hand, then left. Mr. Barlow moved closer to the stock car and fixed hard eyes on Lily and Cole, eyes that said, "This is your fault." That night, Glory took care of Phoebe while Lily and Cole slept in the stock car with Pepper. Hank had pulled the bullets out of Pepper's hide and, to ward off infection, applied a thick coating of zinc ointment to the wounds. Lily lay next to Cole in the straw, awake and silently weeping, trying to grasp the nightmarish reality that JoJo was gone, Pepper had killed Merrick, and now, somehow, Pepper was going to pay for following her natural-born instincts. Just thinking about someone taking Phoebe made Lily's heart cramp with panic and her stomach churn with fear. No wonder Pepper went wild. Lily would have too. The difference between her and Pepper was that no one would shoot her for trying to save her baby. She could only imagine the terror and grief Pepper must have felt when the Rowe and Company handlers took her son, and the pain she must be in now, not only from her physical wounds, but from her shattered heart. How was she even breathing? At least Mr. Barlow didn't let the sheriff kill her, but what was going to happen to Pepper now? Was Mr. Barlow going to make her a workhorse like he said? Or would he try to sell her? Or even worse, would he shoot her and feed her to the cats? Then Lily pictured JoJo, alone and afraid in the boxcar on the other train, and her tears started all over again. She knew that horrible, heavy ache of homesickness in his chest, that helplessness of being ripped from everything familiar, that all-consuming terror of imagining what was going to happen next. Was JoJo wondering why she and Cole and Pepper let strangers take him? Did he think they had gotten rid of him on purpose? The thought of JoJo feeling unloved and discarded was almost more than she could bear. She closed her flooding eyes and prayed for exhaustion to overtake her, to release her into sleep. Hours later, when it finally did, she slept in fit and starts, alternating between dreams of being locked in her old attic bedroom and riding Pepper in the grand parade. The next morning, the stock car door slid open, and sunshine cut like a knife through the gloomy interior, hay chaff and dust floating in the yellow light. Someone entered, and Lily looked toward the door, rubbing her swollen eyes and expecting to see Hank. When she saw Glory standing over her, she bolted upright, fear gripping her throat. "Where's Phoebe?" she said. "Still sleeping," Glory whispered. "Don't worry, she's fine. Penelope is with her." Cole blinked and sat up, his face puffy with sleep. "What's going on?" "What are you doing in here?" Lily asked Glory. "And why are you whispering?" Glory edged closer and knelt in the straw. "I came to warn you," she said. "Alana said a group of local officials paid a visit to Mr. Barlow last night. Seems the town leaders of the next 8 stops on our route threatened to cancel if we have Pepper with us." But Mr. Barlow assured the sheriff she wasn't part of the show anymore, Lily said. He said she's a work animal now.
That doesn't mean they believe him, Cole said.
Cole's right, Glory said. The Rubes can't tell one bull from another. Mr. Barlow could put Pepper back in the ring, and they'd never know the difference.
Then that's what he should do, Lily said. She's not dangerous. She was protecting JoJo.
You and I know that, Cole said, but no one else will believe it.
Mr. Barlow will never put Pepper back in the ring, Glory said. It's too big a risk. If word got out, it means certain ruin.
Then what are you saying? Lily said. What did you come to warn us about?
Penelope overheard Mr. Barlow and Victor talking outside Mr. Barlow's car. Victor wants Pepper to pay for killing Merrick, and Mr. Barlow said no one will book us with a rogue bull in the troupe, even if she's not in the show.
And?
Lily said. Her legs and arms started to vibrate. Glory's eyes grew glassy. Mr. Barlow said there's only one way to prove Pepper is no longer part of the Barlow Brothers Circus. Lily's breath grew shallow and fast.
How?
They're going to...
Glory's chin trembled, and she took Lily's hand with cold, shaking fingers. Lily thought she would scream before Glory told her the rest.
They're going to what? Tell me!
They're going to kill her, Lily. They're going to kill her, and they're going to do it in public.
Oh, my God. No!
Lily cried. She put her hands over her mouth, certain she was going to be sick. Cole put an arm around her, and she stared at Glory, tears burning her eyes.
How?
I don't know, Glory said.
When?
As soon as they can get the word out. Probably tomorrow after the afternoon performance. Lily shook her head.
No.
She looked at Pepper, lying on her side, and watching them with sad, wet eyes.
No, I won't let them.
She crawled over to Pepper and leaned against her, one arm around her front leg. Pepper let out a long, shuddering sigh, lifted her trunk, and draped it across Lily's shoulder.
I'm afraid there's nothing you can do, Cole said softly.
Mr. Barlow will have you arrested, or worse, if you try to stop him.
I'm so sorry.
Lily turned her head to look at him, her face soaked with tears.
Of course there's something I can do. I can get her out of here, and you can help me.
Chapter 28, Julia. In the shadow-filled attic of Blackwood Manor, Julia stood frozen, shining her flashlight at the third door on the other side of the second section of the vast space. At first glance, the door looked set in an outside wall, as if it might lead out to a balcony. But there were no balconies on that side of the house, or any other part of Blackwood Manor for that matter. Besides, unlike the rest of the walls, this wall was made of brick, not wood. She directed the flashlight at the nearest dormer. It looked like all the rest, with a moldy, watermarked window. But the placement seemed odd. It was too close to the brick wall, which meant the wall might have been added later, and there could be more space on the other side of the door. "My God," she said to herself, "how big is this attic?" Shivering with anticipation, she started across the second section. Then she suddenly stopped, shoulders hunched, every sense on high alert. Maybe this part of the attic was walled off and empty because the floor was rotten. She cast the flashlight over the floorboards, looking for cracks or signs of decay. There were none. She pressed one foot into the plank in front of her. It felt firm. She took a deep breath, then carefully crept across the attic, testing each step until she reached the third door. The door was padlocked. "Shit," she whispered. She swept the flashlight along the floor and wall to look for the key.
scanning the brick and mortar for a hook or a hiding place. She searched above the doorframe, her fingers blindly feeling the narrow lip, and came back with nothing but dust. She sighed heavily and tried to think. If she couldn't find the key, maybe she could break the door down. After all, it was her house. She could do whatever she wanted. She rammed her shoulder into it several times. The hasp and padlock rattled, but the door didn't budge. It was like trying to move the brick wall.
"Damn it all to hell and back," she said.
She rubbed her shoulder and frowned at the door. Maybe she could bust it open with an axe. Maybe Fletcher could do it. Or maybe he was strong enough to break the lock. With that thought, she grabbed the padlock to examine it closer. It had been put back in the flange, but the shank had not been pushed into the body. The door had been unlocked the entire time. Berating herself for not checking the padlock sooner, she removed it from the hasp and opened the door. Then she shined the flashlight inside and nearly sank to the floor in astonishment. Her light revealed a cramped, narrow bedroom, complete with a dresser, armoire, and a rusted iron bed beneath a wallpapered nook. Paper flowers hung from the walls and ceilings, their faded petals droopy and gray. The bed looked recently slept in, with a head-shaped indent in the pillow and the red dust-covered duvet pushed to one side. Across from the bed, cobwebs shrouded a white wicker table, a rocking chair, and a short bookcase. Next to the rocking chair, a dollhouse filled with dead bugs and miniature furniture sat on a wooden chest near three porcelain dolls in a wicker pram. Their grimy faces cracked, their hair tangled beneath hoary nets of dirt and spiderwebs. One looked back at Julia with a drooping eyelid, frozen mid-wink. Julia stood there, staring, and too stunned to move. Why was there a bedroom hidden behind three locked doors in the attic of Blackwood Manor? Who in the world had slept there, and why? Judging by the toys, it was a child, a little girl. Icy shivers crawled up the back of Julia's neck. How could anyone do this? How could anyone lock a child in an attic bedroom, and why? It was unimaginable and creepy as hell. Then she noticed the cloth-bound Bible on the nightstand and the cross on the wall, and she knew. Mother had something to do with this. "Dear God," she whispered. The words in her father's journal flashed in her mind. "We have buried our firstborn. May she rest in peace. God speed her soul to heaven, and may God help us for what we have done." A sickening knot of disgust and anger twisted in Julia's gut. Her father's entry said they buried their firstborn, not their newborn. It could have been an older child. A child old enough to play with dolls and make paper flowers. Old enough to read. It could have been my sister, Julia thought. Her knees went weak. What in the world had her parents done? Had they kept their own child locked in this room? Had she died right here in this little bed? And why had they kept her hidden? Was she sick? Deformed? Illegitimate? Another memory came to Julia, and she put a hand over her stomach, suddenly nauseous. Mother always said bad things would happen if she didn't behave. Is that what happened to her sister? Had Mother locked her up for misbehaving? Who would do such a thing? She shook her head. No, that couldn't have been it. It had to be something else. Mother was strict, but she wasn't that strict, was she? And Father wouldn't have gone along with it. Then she had another thought. Maybe that was why her father drank, to bury his guilt. Overcome with the feeling that she didn't know her parents at all, Julia started to tremble. She had wanted answers about her unhappy childhood, and now she was finding them. All this time, Mother had blamed her for father's drinking and death, but something else had been going on inside Blackwood Manor. Something that seemed straight out of a nightmare. And now, no matter how awful it was, Julia was going to get to the bottom of it. Whether she wanted to or not, there was no going back now. She steeled herself and entered the room, casting the flashlight into dark corners. The fusty smell of old wood and warm dust filled the air, stronger and more concentrated than in the rest of the attic, along with an underlying rancid odor that reminded her of finding dead mice in Big Al's diner. She crept over to the bed, moving slowly out of fear or astonishment she wasn't sure, and tried the lamp on the bedside table. The knob clicked, but nothing happened. She shined the flashlight up and down the bed covers. Brown and yellow blotches stained the wrinkled sheet and pillowcase, overlapping at different points in varying degrees of light and dark. She went into the dormer and tried to look out. Black patches of mildew mottled the glass, but she could make out the hawking barn through the rain, the gray scudding clouds above its gabled roof. She imagined a little girl, her sister, standing where she stood, looking out and wondering what else lay beyond this grimy window. Goosebumps rose on her arms. The longer she was in the room, the more nauseous she felt. Pain and despair fell around her like a weight. Something clunked behind her. She spun around and swept the flashlight around the bedroom, her heart racing. Maybe there weren't rats in the attic after all. Maybe it was her sister all along, making the noises in the ceilings and walls. The hairs on the back of her neck stood up. "Hello?" she said. The only sounds were the creak and sway of the house, and the rain filtering through the leaf-choked gutters. "Is someone there?" Nothing. Shaking harder now, she slowly got down on her knees and looked under the bed. The flashlight beam jittered over cobwebs and dust, but no living thing looked back. She stood, took a deep breath, and tried to slow her thundering heart. "You're being ridiculous," she whispered. "There's no one up here but you. Unless your sister is surviving on rats." She pushed the image away and swept the flashlight around the room again. Nothing moved. She gritted her teeth and edged close to the armoire. The door was open a crack. She opened it all the way and shined the flashlight inside. Moth-eaten dresses and yellowed blouses hung from the clothes bar, and several pairs of little girls' shoes lined the bottom. But they weren't toddler shoes. They looked big enough for a 7- or 8-year-old. My God, how long was she up here? All her life? Or only after she had grown old enough to misbehave? What looked like a white dress lay crumpled in the bottom corner of the armoire. She reached in to pick it up, then let out a screech and jumped back. A small skeleton lay on top of the dress, its dusty brown spine curled against the inside wall. She stared at the armoire, breathing hard and trying to pull herself together. If the skeleton belonged to a child, she didn't know what she would do. Scream? Throw up? Call the police? She held her breath and peered in again. The flashlight beam illuminated tiny brown ribs, an elongated skull, sharp teeth, and a segmented tail. It looked like a cat. She exhaled and straightened. Thank God it wasn't a child, but finding the remains of a cat was still upsetting. Had the poor thing been left alone up here to starve? Who would do such an awful thing? The same people who locked a little girl in this attic, her mind screamed. Your parents. She pictured a little girl reading in the rocking chair, or having a tea party at the wicker table with her dolls. She could see her in the little bed, curled up with her beloved cat, trying to understand why she felt so lost and unloved. Suddenly, a profound sense of loneliness and misery overwhelmed her, as if every emotion absorbed by the bedroom walls had been released all at once. Either that, or her sister's ghost was in the room with her. It was more than she could take. Overcome by the feeling that she was stuck in a nightmare or horror movie, she rushed out of the room, shut the door, and made her way across the divided attic. After going through the second door, she scurried through the maze of dusty books and boxes and shelves toward the hidden staircase, panic growing in her mind. What if the little door at the bottom of the steps was closed and locked? What if she was stuck up there forever? The idea was absurd, but when she saw the dim light glowing through the opening in the floor that led to the stairway, a flood of relief washed through her. The door at the bottom of the steps was open. With one hand against the gritty wall for support, and the other gripping the flashlight, she went down the steps, which somehow seemed steeper and narrower than before. At the bottom, she closed and locked the door, fully aware there was no reason to lock it. At the same time, a small frightened part of her imagined her sister still living in the attic, sneaking out the door in the middle of the night. And after all those years alone up there, she had to be insane. It was a crazy, ridiculous notion, but then again, she never thought she'd find a hidden bedroom in the attic of her childhood home. Without bothering to roll down the tapestry or return the clawfoot table to its original place, she left the little room and hurried downstairs to the first floor. In her father's den, she picked up his journal off the desk and flipped to the first page with trembling fingers. The entry marking the death of her sister was 1940. Julia had been 2 years old. She sank into the chair, her mind racing and her insides churning. While her sister had been locked in the attic, she'd been downstairs playing with toys, laughing and taking naps, oblivious to the horrors being committed a few floors up. There were no rats in the walls of Blackwood Manor, just a little girl hidden in the attic. It was horrible and inconceivable and unreal. Chapter 29. Lily. At 12:30 the day after Pepper killed Merrick, Lily and Cole crept out of their sleeper car, suitcases in hand. Phoebe sound asleep in a cloth sling against Cole's chest, unaware her parents were leading her into an uncertain future. The night was still and humid, and a half-moon cast a bluish glow over the train and ground and trees, emitting just enough light for them to see where they were going. Cole had a lantern in his backpack, but didn't care to use it until they were far enough away not to be caught. Earlier, they had talked for hours about what saving Pepper would mean for the three of them, and decided that, despite the risks of starting over with nothing but their clothes and a little money, they wouldn't be able to live with themselves if they stood by and did nothing. Cole hoped they'd find a new circus, willing to take them in, along with a free, albeit rogue, bull. Because where else would an albino, a lifelong circus performer, and an elephant have any sort of chance at starting over? If that plan didn't work, he wasn't sure what they would do, but Lily insisted they try. After the decision was made, they asked Hank over to their car to say goodbye. He agreed they had to save Pepper and wanted to go with him, but Cole refused in case they got caught. Hank understood and made them promise to find a way to let him know where they landed and if they were safe. He took Phoebe in his lap and kissed her cheeks until she got tired and wanted her mother. Lily hugged him and Cole, promised they'd see each other again, and if a spot for an experienced bullman opened up in their next digs, he'd send word. By the time Hank left, they were all in tears. Now, Lily followed Cole along the train, fear and adrenaline roaring through her veins. A fine sheen of nervous sweat on her forehead. She felt like she was about to jump out of her skin. If they got caught or escaped, who knew what would happen? When they reached the elephant car, Cole stopped, shoulders hunched and held up a hand. Lily came to a halt behind him and waited while he slowly slid open the stock car door, cringing with every metal rasp and scrape. When it was finally open all the way, Cole acted as a lookout, and she climbed inside, crept across the aisle, and crouched beside Pepper, praying she'd be able to get the broken-hearted, injured bull up and out of the car without too much noise. Pepper lay on her side in the straw, streaks of dried tears on her wrinkled face. Lily ran a gentle hand down her giant ear, and Pepper opened her eyes and lifted her head. Her long trunk unfurled like a fern leaf and reached for Lily's arm.
"Up," Lily whispered. "Get up, girl."
Pepper groaned and struggled to her feet. Flossie and Petunia craned their necks to see what was going on, snuffling and snorting when they saw Lily. She went over and rubbed their trunks, whispering that they should go back to sleep. The elephants sighed, low and rumbling, and put their trunks back down. Lily unlocked the chain around Pepper's leg, wrapped it around Pepper's ankle, and secured it in place. Then she started toward the door, hoping the great beast would be willing and able to get out of the car without using the ramp. Otherwise, it would take too long and make too much noise. Pepper followed her out of the stall, and Lily climbed out of the stock car. In the open doorway, Pepper hesitated, no doubt confused and in pain. Lily quietly begged her to come down, rubbing her plate-sized feet and telling her it would be okay. Pepper swayed back and forth, unsure. Cole watched with a worried face, and Lily felt panic rising in her chest. If they had to use the ramp, they'd get caught for sure. Then, at last, Pepper stepped out of the car, her great gray heft shuddering when her front foot hit the ground. She grumbled deep in her throat, but kept coming, her rear end high in the air, her front feet on the ground. For a heart-stopping second, Lily thought she might fall out of the door. If she got hurt, they'd be done for. Then, finally, Pepper managed to pull one of her back legs out and bring the other one down too, and Lily could breathe again. Once Pepper was free of the car and standing on all fours, Cole slowly slid the door shut, and they started walking toward the end of the train. Pepper lumbered behind Lily, stopping when she stopped, slowed when she slowed. Together, they took a wide berth around Mr. Barlow's car and the caboose, then followed the tracks away from the Barlow Brothers Circus. The only things Lily could hear were the blood rushing through her veins and the anxious thud of her heart. She turned every once in a while to make sure Pepper was still behind them. In the weak moonlight, the bull's silhouette swayed side to side, the dark wings of her ears slowly fanning forward and back, her mighty legs plodding along the tracks like the limbs of a prehistoric creature. When Lily felt sure they had escaped undiscovered, she unclenched her jaw and her heartbeat slowed. She hooked her arm through Cole's and leaned against his shoulder as they walked along the railroad ties, nearly limp with relief. Phoebe was still sound asleep in the sling, her little blonde head bobbing against Cole's chest in time with his strides. Neither Lily nor Cole spoke, each lost in their own thoughts and fears about the future. The only thing they knew for sure was they were headed west, toward a town named Waverly, where rumor had it the Sparks World Circus was being cannibalized by Ringling. If the three of them didn't get picked up by Ringling, at least they'd have better luck finding a new circus with the remnants of Sparks World than they would on their own. Lily had already imagined a new act with Pepper, one that included Cole and Phoebe, and now she rehearsed it in her mind to calm her nerves. Then she saw the silhouette of someone on the tracks, and she came to a halt. Cole took another step, then stopped too. The person was quite large, with an unusually big head and broad shoulders, and he was coming toward them. It was Victor. Cole pulled Lily off the tracks toward a line of trees.
"Come," Lily said to Pepper as loud as she dared.
Pepper followed, crashing through the dry brush like a tank.
"Stop right there," Victor shouted. "That damn bull isn't getting off that easy."
He turned on a flashlight and shined it in their direction. Lily and Cole froze, and she grabbed his arm, her blood running cold. Victor had a gun. Chapter 30, Julia. The morning after finding the hidden staircase up to the attic, Julia pulled herself out of bed and looked out the window. To her surprise, the sun was out, and Claude had already piled the broken branches and sticks from the ice storm in the side yard. She glanced at the clock on her bedside table. It was already 9:30. How in the world had she slept so long? Then the memory of finding the attic bedroom hit her, and she sat down hard on her bed. Her mind felt like she had lived 1,000 years, and for some reason, her body ached like it too. Either that, or she was coming down with something. No, that wasn't it. After learning she had a sister, finding the hidden bedroom, and speculating nonstop about what her parents had done, it was no wonder she wanted to sleep. It was too much to digest all at once, and she wanted it to go away. And yet, she had to know the truth. There was no other choice. She got dressed, made her way down to the kitchen, and stood at the sink, staring out the window. How in the world was she going to fit all the pieces together? Why was her sister locked in the attic, and for how long? What happened to her? Did her parents have something to do with her death? Where was she buried? Was there a birth certificate? A death certificate? Was it possible the albino woman, Lily, had something to do with this? Or was she a separate issue altogether? Could the little girl have been Lily's child? An illegitimate baby shamefully hidden away when mother found out about the affair? There were probably more clues in the attic, but it would take months to go through everything, and Julia couldn't wait that long. Besides, she wouldn't know where to start. Her parents wouldn't have wanted anyone to know they were hiding a child in the attic, so there probably wasn't anyone to question. But someone, somewhere, had to know something. Then it hit her. There was one person who had been here through everything. Claude. She put on boots and a jacket, went out the back door, and marched over to the barn. Claude was at the desk in the office doing paperwork. He glanced up when she came in.
"Morning," he said, then looked down at his work again.
"Morning," she said.
She waited on the other side of the desk, her hands in her jacket pockets to keep them from shaking. She wasn't sure if she was worried he'd tell her the truth, or worried he'd refuse to talk again.
"I see you cleaned up the yard," she said.
He kept his eyes on the papers.
"Almost," he said. "There's still a few branches lying around, but most of it's ready to be burned."
"I can do that."
"Suit yourself."
He penciled numbers into a ledger, concentrating. She bit her lip, unsure how to begin. If he didn't help her, she wouldn't know what to do next.
"I know you're busy," she said, "but can you come over to the house for a minute?"
"What for?"
"I need you to see something."
He turned a ledger page and wrote down more numbers.
"What is it? I've got to finish these accounts."
"I'm not sure," she said. "That's why I need you to take a look."
He finally looked up at her, his forehead furrowed.
"Why don't you ask Fletcher? He'll be here in a few minutes."
She shook her head.
"Fletcher can't help me with this, and I don't have anyone else to ask. I found something in the house, something horrible and shocking, and..." And if I don't figure out what my parents...
Her voice caught in her throat, and she pressed her fingers against her lips for a moment, trying to stop the sudden flow of tears. When she could speak again, she said,
I just want to know the truth.
He leaned back in his chair and studied her face, as if sizing her up or judging her motives. Anger hardened his features, but she held his gaze, refusing to look away. If he read the determination in her eyes, so be it. She needed him to tell her what he knew. After what seemed like forever, he sat forward, took off his cap, and scrubbed a hand over his graying hair. He set the cap on the desk and clasped his hands together against his mouth, thinking. Then he looked her in the eye. She thought he was going to refuse to help again, but his brow relaxed and his unyielding eyes softened. Defiance turned into something that looked like sadness, or maybe it was regret.
You found a way into the attic, he said. It wasn't a question.
Her legs went watery.
Mm-hmm,
she managed.
And the hidden bedroom.
She nodded, pulled a stool away from the wall, and sat down before she fell.
What do you know about it?
He scratched the back of his neck and frowned, hesitant to go on. When he finally spoke, his voice was tight, as if the words were hard to say.
Your parents had another child.
She nodded again.
She wasn't normal.
Julia swallowed.
What do you mean? Was she deformed or something?
He stood and made his way around the desk, then headed toward the door. She thought he was going to leave, and she got to her feet, ready to beg him to stay. But he stopped and stared out the window next to the door. She sat back down, studying his profile. He looked troubled.
It's what people did back then, he said.
His voice sounded different, sad almost, or maybe it was weary.
I suppose it was better than being put in an institution somewhere.
I don't know, she said. Maybe if she had gotten help.
It wasn't my business.
She wanted to ask why a child being locked in an attic wasn't his business, but refrained herself. If she made him mad, he might clam up again.
What was wrong with her?
I'm not sure. Some sort of skin condition, I think, but your father said she had other problems.
Julia stiffened.
Skin condition? What kind of skin condition?
Albinism? Her mind reeled.
Was it possible Lily was her sister, not her father's mistress?
Is that why her father went to the circus all the time? But if her sister was locked in the attic, how and when did she get out? How did she end up joining the circus? It didn't seem possible.
Did you ever see her?
Claude pressed his lips together and shook his head. He was lying again, she could tell.
Was she an albino? She said.
I don't know. Your father didn't say much about her. He and Mrs. Blackwood were...
Ashamed?
He turned to look at her.
I was gonna say private. Mr. and Mrs. Blackwood were very private people. And I can't be sure, but their decision might have something to do with Mrs. Blackwood's religious beliefs.
In what way?
He shrugged. It's just the feeling I got.
What was her name?
I don't know.
Was it Lily?
I'm not sure.
What happened to her?
He shrugged again and went back to his desk.
Is she dead?
Julia pressed. He sat down and shuffled through the papers.
Listen, that's all I know. Like I said, your father didn't talk about her much. I think it was too hard for him.
He put his cap back on and picked up a pencil, his face guarded again.
Now, if you don't mind, I've got work to do.
Julia dug her fingernails into her palms, struggling to stay calm. He wasn't telling her everything, and she had no idea why. They were talking about her house, her parents, her sister. She had a right to know what happened. Frustration and anger built up like steam inside her head. She got up, snatched the papers from his desk, and held them out of his reach.
"I don't believe you," she said. "If my parents didn't want anyone to know about my sister, why would my father tell you she was up in the attic? He must have trusted you, with all of it."
He frowned. "I don't know. It was a long time ago. Maybe he needed to get it off his chest."
"Did you go to the police? Did you try to get her out of there?"
He shook his head.
"Why not?"
"By the time your father told me, it was..."
He shifted in his chair. "It was what?"
"It was too late."
"Too late for what?"
He clenched his jaw, his temples working in and out. "You're asking questions I don't have the answers to."
It was all she could do not to throw the papers at him.
"I don't understand why you're lying," she said.
"My parents are dead, so who are you protecting?"
"I'm not protecting anyone."
"Did my sister die up there? Did she escape? I need to know what happened."
"I told you. I don't know anything else. I made it my business not to know."
She dropped the papers on the desk, sadness and disgust welling up in her eyes. Several of them slid into his lap, but he made no move to retrieve them. She went to the door and glared back at him. "Then you're just as guilty as my parents," she said, and walked out. Chapter 31. Lily.
"I can't take this much longer," Lily said to Cole. "What is Mr. Barlow going to do to us for stealing Pepper?"
They were sitting on the sofa, locked inside their sleeper car on the rail lot where Pepper killed Merrick. Roustabouts and strongmen guarding the windows and doors. It had been nearly 15 hours since Victor forced them back to the train by gunpoint, and she couldn't stop thinking about the three birds in the big top during the tornado. Three birds, three deaths. Merrick was dead, so who was next? Her and Cole?
"I don't know," Cole said. "If he was going to call the cops and have us arrested, he would have done it by now. Knowing him, he's coming up with his own punishment."
Lily hugged her daughter to her chest and kissed the top of her head, tears burning her eyes.
"If something happens to us, who will take care of Phoebe?"
Cole put an arm around her. "Try not to worry. I'll talk to Mr. Barlow. Maybe he'll let us work without pay for a few years, or I can take the punishment for both of us. Whatever happens, you're not going to be separated from our little girl. I promise."
Lily closed her eyes and buried her nose into Phoebe's silky hair. What had they done? Not only had they failed to save Pepper, but they had put their daughter's future in danger too. Just then, the pounding chug of an approaching locomotive thudded outside. A short train passed by the windows of their car, and iron brakes caught and screeched. Cole got up and pushed aside the curtain to look out.
"My God," he said in a quiet voice.
"What is it?"
Lily set Phoebe on the sofa and went to the window.
On the other side of a second set of tracks, a crowd of townies had gathered around the train depot. Men, women, and children filled every available spot, perched on top of lone boxcars, sitting inside open car doors, standing on water tower stairs and overturned barrels. The adults jostled one another for prime viewing space, while children held balloons and ate popcorn and cotton candy, or played tag in front of the platform. A half dozen men set up cameras.
"That bastard got the word out all right," Cole said. "He must have made an announcement during this afternoon's show."
"Do you think he sold tickets?" Lily said.
"No, it's a publicity stunt."
Lily buried her face in her hands. Poor Pepper.
Cole pulled her to him, and they both grew quiet. When Lily could speak around the lump in her throat, she looked up and said, "How do you think he's going to do it?" Cole jerked his chin toward the window to indicate the locomotive that had just pulled in. "With that." Lily drew away from him and looked out. The locomotive sat on the tracks several hundred feet away, situated halfway between the Barlow brothers' train and the depot. Only one rail car sat behind the engine. A derrick car mounted with an industrial crane used for lifting railway carriages on and off the tracks.
"I don't understand," Lily said. "How?"
Before she could finish her question, keys rattled in their door. The handle turned and Victor walked in with Mr. Barlow's men.
"Let's go,"
he snarled at Cole and Lily.
"Where?"
Cole said.
"Mr. Barlow wants you to witness the execution," he said.
"How can you go along with this?" Lily cried. "Pepper was only trying to protect JoJo. Even Glory understands that."
"Merrick saved my life," Victor said. "That bull killed him."
"Do you really think Merrick took you out of that asylum because he cared?" she said. "He did it to make money off you, the same way he made money off me."
"Shut up and let's go," Victor said.
"No," Lily said. "I can't. I won't."
"I'll go," Cole said. "Let her stay here with Phoebe."
With that, one of Mr. Barlow's men rushed Cole and wrestled his arm behind his back. On the sofa, Phoebe began to wail.
"What the hell?"
Cole said. He grimaced and struggled to get away.
"Mr. Barlow wants you both there," Victor said.
The other man made a move to grab Lily.
"Leave her alone," Cole shouted.
Lily moved away from the strong man and put up her hands.
"All right, all right, I'll come," she said. "There's no need for force."
She whisked Phoebe off the sofa and held her close.
"Shh, sweet baby. Mommy's right here."
"I said I'd cooperate," Cole said. "Now let me go."
The man released Cole, but stayed beside him, ready to grab him again if necessary. Cole rubbed his arm and gazed at Lily, silently warning her to go along with whatever they said. Lily stared back, terror and grief twisting in her chest. Together, they followed Victor out of the sleeper car and along the train, trailed by Mr. Barlow's men. A thousand horrible thoughts raced through Lily's mind, and her legs and arms felt like rubber.
"Let me leave Phoebe with Glory," Lily said to Victor. "She doesn't need to see this."
Victor said nothing, but stopped farther along the train outside Glory's car. Glory took Phoebe with tears in her eyes and hugged Lily and Cole, refusing to look at her brother.
"Everything's gonna be okay," she whispered in Lily's ear. "Don't worry."
Lily nodded and kissed Phoebe's soft cheek, her eyes flooding. Then followed Victor around to the other side of the train. They stopped across from the crowded depot, next to a group of railroad officials, important-looking men in suits and shiny shoes, and the sheriff who shot Pepper. The townies who hadn't seen Victor yet pointed and stared at him, and numerous children ran frightened and crying to their mothers. Several hundred yards away, a trio of railroad men used a steam shovel to dig a giant grave in an empty lot. Lily clung to Cole, trembling in the grip of impending doom. With everyone in place, Mr. Barlow promenaded out from behind the derrick car, smiling in his top hat and red jacket. He faced the audience and lifted his hands and chin, as if getting ready to announce an act inside the big top, then waved an arm to one side to draw everyone's attention to his left. A group of animal handlers brought Pepper out of the Barlow brothers' train, whacking her with bull hooks and cattle prods. Pepper lifted her trunk and bellowed with each strike before hurrying forward. Streaks of blood ran down her sides and legs. When she reached the derrick, the handlers chained her back leg to the tracks and moved away. Every beat of Lily's heart felt like an explosion beneath her ribcage. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. Mr. Barlow was going to execute Pepper, and in front of all these people, people who had come to see her killed, and humans called animals bloodthirsty. Pepper swayed back and forth next to the tracks, shaking and trembling. She knew something bad was going to happen. Then she saw Lily and lifted her trunk. She trumpeted and reached out in desperation, her wide ears fanning back and forth. Lily swallowed a sob and started toward her. She had to get to Pepper, to comfort her, and apologize for not doing more to save her. If Pepper was going to die, she deserved to know she was loved. Victor caught Lily and yanked her back. Cole tore Victor's hand from her arm. "Don't touch her," he snarled. "Tell her to stay put," Victor said. Cole pulled Lily close. "I'm sorry," he said. "I know you want to help, but there's nothing you can do." She sagged against him. He was right. And the fact that Pepper might think she and Cole had something to do with her execution felt like a knife in her heart. A roustabout threw a heavy chain around Pepper's neck, fastened it like a noose, and fitted the end through a steel ring on the derrick cable. Mr. Barlow signaled the derrick operator, and the crowd grew quiet.
"Oh my God," Lily cried. "You can't do this! You can't do this!"
"Shut up," Victor growled.
The derrick operator pulled a handle back. The winch squealed, and the chain rattled and constricted around Pepper's neck. Lily's knees went weak, and the blood drained from her face. The chain pulled tighter and tighter, slowly lifting Pepper's front feet off the ground. Pepper struggled and bellowed and threw her head back and forth, her eyes wide with terror. Bile rose in the back of Lily's throat, and for a second, she thought she was going to pass out. Then there was a gruesome ripping sound, and Pepper screamed. The audience gasped. The derrick operator lowered Pepper onto the tracks, and the chain loosened around her neck. Two roustabouts ran over and undid the chain around her back leg, but her ankle was already torn open. A rush of adrenaline surged through Lily, and she yanked herself from Cole's arms and ran toward Pepper.
"Lily, no!"
Cole shouted. He chased after her, but Victor grabbed him and held him back. When Lily reached the terrified bull, she slowed. Pepper was panicking, moving back and forth and side to side, shaking her head and trying to get loose of the chain. The roustabouts and handlers stayed clear.
"It's all right, Pepper," Lily said, holding out a hand. "I'm gonna help you. It's okay."
At first, Pepper didn't respond. Then she noticed Lily and stopped struggling. A deep, mournful sound rumbled in her throat. Out of the corner of her eye, Lily saw Mr. Barlow storming toward them. She moved closer to Pepper.
"Come on, girl," she said. "Pick me up."
Pepper limped forward, wrapped her trunk around Lily, and lifted her onto her head. Lily moved to Pepper's back, grabbed the derrick cable, and tried undoing the chain from the steel ring. If she could get Pepper free of the noose, or even if she couldn't, she was going to stay put until Mr. Barlow agreed not to follow through with the execution. He wouldn't kill Pepper while Lily was on top of her, not in public anyway. After that, she had no idea what would happen, but she had to try something. She pulled down on the steel ring, struggled to loosen the cable and release the chain. It was too tight.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" Mr. Barlow yelled up at her. "Get down from there!"
Behind him, a group of roustabouts were closing in. Cole had gotten away from Victor and was running toward her, Victor on his heels. Mr. Barlow signaled the derrick operator again. Despite the fact that Lily was standing on top of the bull, the winch powered up, the operator pulled the handle, and the cable tightened. Lily lost her balance and fell to her knees. She nearly slipped off Pepper's back, but held onto the chain around her neck. Women gasped and pulled their children into their skirts, while men craned their necks to get a better look. Cole ran over to the derrick car, scrambling up the side, grabbed the operator by the shirt, and hauled him out of the cab. Then he climbed into the driver's seat, pushed the handle forward, and the cable went loose. Lily stood and struggled to undo the chain again. Victor climbed up the derrick car, seized Cole by the collar, and punched him hard in the face. Cole listed to one side, seemingly out cold, then straightened and rammed a fist into Victor's steam-shovel jaw. Unfazed, Victor punched Cole again, harder this time, then dragged him out of the operator's seat and took his place. Four roustabouts latched on to Cole's legs, yanked him down from the car, and held him to the ground. Cole thrashed and cussed, frantically fighting to get away. One of Mr. Barlow's strongmen kicked him in the head, and he went limp, his face turned to one side. In the derrick operator's seat, Victor pushed the levers and moved the handle, and the crane swung to the left, jerking Pepper in the same direction. Lily tumbled sideways and straddled Pepper's neck, hanging on for dear life. When the crane slowly swung back again, she scrambled to her feet, reached for the steel ring, and tried to pull down on the chain at the same time. Victor jostled the handle forward and to the right, and the crane lowered and swung to the other side. The cable loosened, and Lily yanked down on the steel ring and struggled to undo the chain. A whooshing noise sounded above her head, and she looked up. The boom of the crane dropped down and over, then switched direction and headed straight at her. Before she could react, it slammed into her stomach, cracked her ribcage, and knocked her off Pepper's back. In what seemed like slow motion, she flew through the air, her lungs empty and useless, her arms and hair out like the limbs of a falling doll. She struck a railroad switch several yards away, the metal sign smashing into her lower spine, the sound of splintering bones exploding in her brain. She screamed and hit the ground with a thud, her body rigid with agony. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she heard the crowd gasp. The world swam in and out of focus, blurred behind a bloody film of tears. She closed her eyes, panting and trying to hold on to consciousness. Her torso burned as if someone had set her on fire. After what seemed like forever, the dizziness passed and she opened her eyes. On her side in the dirt, she was facing the circus train, and her legs and arms felt bent at odd angles. Several railroad officials and the sheriff rushed toward her. Behind them, Mr. Barlow's strongmen dragged Cole away. She gritted her teeth and tried to sit up. Her arms worked, but she couldn't push herself off the ground. The pain in her middle was like nothing she had ever felt before. Every breath like 100 twisting blades in her spine. She tried to roll over, but no matter how hard she struggled, she couldn't move. She looked down at her stomach, a gore-streaked bar stuck out of her lower abdomen, and blood oozed from the wound. Oddly, she felt no pain. She touched the area around the metal bar, and sticky blood coated her finger. "Once that's out, I'll be fine," she thought. A cluster of boots and shoes appeared, and the sheriff knelt beside her, his face lined with alarm. "Don't move," he said. "You're gonna be okay." Behind her, the derrick crane powered up again. The winch squealed, and the chain rattled. "No," she said, reaching for the sheriff with a bloody hand. Don't let them kill Pepper." "Just hold on and we'll get help," the sheriff said. He stood and shouted, "Someone get an ambulance!" Behind Lily, the crane creaked, the cable whined, and the crowd laughed and clapped. Pepper bellowed several times, then let out shriek after agonized shriek. Lily put her hands over her